You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got Tebow. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chad Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the studio, it's Neil Statman Payne. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Chad.
Neil, did you notice that the shot caller who broke the mold got a hit in a Major League spring training game? Tim Tebow has recorded a hit.
I'm snarling.
Kate is snarling.
And also, we had a crazy, although not as crazy as people thought, but still a crazy March snowstorm. So I think these are all signs of the apocalypse. And I look forward to seeing what happens next.
With the doomsayer himself, it's Hot Takedown's chief meteorologist and ESPNW columnist, Kate Fagan. Kate, you made it in despite the snowstorm that wasn't quite what it was billed to be.
Hi, Chad.
Hi.
I did. Well, since I'm the chief meteorologist, I knew over the last few hours that I would be able to come in and then also get home relatively easily because the snow was going to be easing up and wasn't as intense as people predicted.
We should know that the only people from 538 in the office today are associated with Hot Takedown. And I think that just shows the dedication to the podcast and to our listener community.
And I know it's slightly off topic, but you seem to be wearing a Monopoly sweatshirt.
This,
I can't quite tell.
Listeners, you'll love this story because you can't see the sweatshirt. This is a sweatshirt from an old website I used to work for called The Big Money. It's a business site that Slate started. And this little Monopoly guy was our logo.
Oh, okay. I mean, we always reference Neil's hats, so I figure we could reference your... I didn't know if it was like an anti-capitalist sweatshirt or not.
That
I couldn't quite tell.
That was the trick. That's what makes it a great logo.
It's ambiguous. Cool.
On today's show... Oh, first, before we get to the billboard, guys, it's our second or third. It's our third anniversary of Hot Takedown.
No way.
We started it the week of
that's not possible.
March Madness. Two March Madnesses ago.
Feels like longer.
It was the March Madness of Kentucky. Wasn't that 2 years ago?
Kentucky was our second one, I think.
That was three tournaments ago, right?
Wow.
Yeah.
If we've been doing this for 3 years, that's amazing.
Right?
And we're still dedicated.
Right? I think it's pretty good. Neil's got nothing to offer.
I still can't believe it's actually three, but maybe.
I think it's been three... Okay,
we'll figure it out by the end of the show.
It depends on how you treat birthdays.
It's been two full years.
This is our third tournament.
We're working on our third year.
All right. The stat man stat checks me. You're right. I'm sorry, everybody. I just wanted to feel like I'd been around you even longer. All right, on today's show, we'll talk about March Madness. The brackets are out. We'll talk about the women's tournament and the men's tournament, UConn, Villanova, the two favorites going into the respective tournaments. And then NFL free agency Mina Kimes, ESPN the Magazine's Mina Kimes, will swing by on the phone to talk about what is happening with the quarterback carousel in the NFL and why offensive linemen are worth so much money all of a sudden. And we've been told that Eddie Lacy should also be on our discussion.
I will be talking about Eddie Lacy.
Wonderful.
Look forward to that.
And then, of course, our significant digit as well. One announcement before we go to the show. The Hot Takedown Bracket Challenge is back.
Ooh.
It's on ESPN. Search for Hot Takedown when you go to ESPN and fill out your tournament challenge bracket. It should come up no problem. The group ID, in case you need it, is 1322025. But the group is called Hot Takedown. You should find us no problem. I filled out a chalk bracket so far. I may or may not remember to fix it before Thursday.
Oh, yeah.
Same here.
And we're doing men's and women's tournaments again.
I have to fill out a bracket where I pick by mascots. It's a satire that we're doing for my Saturday radio show. So I have to make sure that I don't use that one for any other. Because the mascot.
Sorry, did you say it's a satire that you're doing?
Yeah, our radio show on Saturday mornings is all women. And so we each make a bracket by like the stereotypes that
that's pretty good.
People usually think women pick brackets by. So one's doing cutest coaches, I'm doing mascots, and another one's doing colors.
Yeah, team.
Very
color.
Funny. It's really hard on the radio to get people to understand the sarcasm of it, but we try really hard. popping into a segment, and they don't know that it's a stereotype.
Right, that's if I'm fine. Just turning the dial on my car, all of a sudden I hear people over here.
Women talking about cute coaches.
Yeah, what's that where, like, any sufficiently, like, sarcastic or parody is indistinguishable yep. from, like, an extreme version of the real thing?
Yep.
All right, should we talk about sports?
We should.
All right, great. It's March. I'm ready for March Madness. I'm really excited, guys. My favorite 3 weeks of sports, I think. I say that every year here on Hot Takedown for the last decade that we've been doing the show. And,
I thought it was 20 years. Yeah. It's only been 10.
It keeps growing.
Time flies, Kate. Yeah. Time flies. Let's start with the women's bracket, where the bracket was announced on Monday night. We're recording this on Tuesday. UConn is the number one seed in their region and also the overall number one seed, I'm sure.
What a shock.
538s. March Madness predictions.
Yeah, dun-dun-dun.
We run all sorts of numbers through a model. The model, you know, does some calculations, and the model says that UConn is a 52%, has a 52% chance.
Run it through
That's
again.
Weak.
Of winning.
That is
run it through again.
Disappointing
There's
result.
A glitch talk in the
to,
model.
Talk to me why, Kate.
Why it's 52 or why I think it's
Why
low.
It's glitch, yeah.
It's a
Take
glitch.
Take down the model.
Well, it's a glitch because the model can't talk to you about history in the same way that you can. It does talk to you about history. I feel like
Elo
you need
loves
to
history.
I feel like you need to ask Neil why it's a glitch.
No,
I
but why? But you had a visceral reaction.
Yeah,
to
my
saying 50%.
Visceral reaction was I thought it would be 97%. I know that's high, but basically a number that said, okay, this model is simply allowing for some sort of radical outcome that nobody thinks is going to happen. Whereas 52% is telling me that it's not just allowing for the possibility of something to happen, but it's almost saying that the possibility that UConn win is even with the possibility that they don't win.
But they have six games to win. And we talked about that when Kentucky was undefeated. And we shouldn't forget here that UConn is going for
They
third
have to win
straight championship.
Six in a row? Oh, wow. Haven't they won the whatever?
You're right. Okay. So it's a great point.
Yeah, what is it?
They won 100. They have won 107 games in a row. If they were to win this, it would be their fifth championship in a row and their third since last losing a game.
The
of
last
any sort.
Time they lost a game, President Trump hadn't even announced his candidacy.
We were all.
I like
young
to tie together politics and sports whenever I can. So I did it.
It was a simpler
so,
time.
Okay. So, but we talked about this in Kentucky a little bit, which is that yeah. it's really hard to win six games consecutively, no matter who you are. Your point is that UConn is like, unlike any other. My question for you is this UConn team as dominant as years in the past? They certainly have gone undefeated. That's undeniable. However, their competition is closer to them than they once yeah. were. Our colleague Ben Morris is doing this thing called we're calling Perfection Tracker in-house as UConn chases perfection for what would that be 113 games in a row. And University of Maryland, South Carolina, Baylor, Notre Dame, they are all in the region that UConn has been this season. While UConn in the region of
wrong points. Wording.
Yeah, yeah, good point. In the quadrant. Okay. No, also wrong. Of points scored per possession on offense and points scored per points allowed per possession on defense. Neil, rescue me from myself. Cut in.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more about what you said about teams being closer to UConn than they're used to being, really, in any of the years that we kind of have power ratings for them compared with them falling off. So, for instance, last year, if you look at Jeff Sagarin's ratings, which is kind of one of the best or one of the only on the women's side power ratings that you can get, he has this scale that is theoretically on a 0 to 100 scale, but when you're UConn, you can go over 100, and it kind of corresponds to point differentials between teams. But UConn was a 116 last year, and the next best team was Baylor, who was a 101. So that would mean
and
on
that's
a
when they had a
court,
when UConn had a 71% chance to win the tournament.
Right, exactly. Yeah, our model gave them a 71% chance going into the tournament itself, and that would mean against the next best team in the country statistically that UConn should have been favored by about 15 points on a neutral court. And then you go down to Maryland and it's 16 points and Notre Dame 16. And so you end up with this like huge just gap between UConn and the rest of the field. And that explains, you know, a lot of their huge probability going into the tournament. Fast forward to this year, UConn is a 112. So they've gone down really, you could argue, a lot less than you might expect given how many players they lost, Breanna Stewart and so on and so forth. They've rebuilt and kind of retooled on the fly, certainly well enough to go 32-0, but also to have a pretty comparable rating. But the problem is Baylor is a 108. South Carolina is a 101.5. These are teams that there are a lot more teams that are closer, most notably that gap between number one UConn and number two Baylor. That's the smallest gap that UConn has had over the next best team in the country since we've been tracking these ratings and kind of can put a number on their talent. So I think that is the biggest determinant of this big drop-off in pre-tournament championship odds, is that the rest of the field has in a lot of ways caught up to them.
Yeah, and even looking at a Maryland who I think a lot of people were surprised got a 3 seed and was put in UConn's region, even though they only had 2 losses, and also played UConn the closest of anyone this season. I think it was a 6-point game. So I can see how the model would show that the road for UConn, when you talk about, okay, having to possibly beat Maryland just to get to the Final Four.
Yeah, we say there's a 62% chance that they'll face Maryland on the eve of the Final Four.
Right. And but I'm wondering, when it comes to 538's model for UConn, I know, because it's one of my favorite nuggets of information that I point out elsewhere on ESPN, that in that model is preseason rankings. Wouldn't some of that hurt UConn because their preseason ranking was actually like third when usually they're first? I'm kind of wondering if those preseason rankings were as strong as they usually are for UConn, would that bump up their percentage chance of winning any significant degree?
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, yeah.
I'm only pointing it out because some of the reason I think they were ranked low was just like wishful thinking, as opposed
right.
to the
mm-hmm.
usual preseason rankings having a lot of value baked in about talent. Whereas with UConn, it feels like it was like, God, we just need to vote someone
voting
else.
Well, fatigue.
But it's also that Maryland and Baylor are on their side of the bracket. And so if they weren't, then maybe if the other side of the bracket gets stacked, then UConn is going to have an easier run to the tournament and then maybe a tight game in the final game of the tournament, but a higher chance overall because they don't have as many blocks. But Neil, you were going to talk about the preseasons.
Yeah, I mean, so it's worth saying that in the coaches poll, UConn still was number one, and I believe we used kind of a mix of all of those available rankings. But yeah, there's probably like, you know, instead of being the clear number one, clear cut, maybe they're like a 1B to like Notre Dame's 1A or something going into the season, and then that can filter through. Now, ideally, we would have, you know, if this were not UConn we're talking about, but kind of like generic team A that finished third in the preseason AP,
yeah.
but had a great year and went 32-0, and also had the best power rating of any team, that theoretically we would have calibrated the model well enough in order to kind of figure out how much weight to put on each of those different, you know, kind of countervailing forces. Now, the problem is, A, we don't have much of a sample to train things off of on the women's side, and so it's possible that because UConn has been so dominant for so long that maybe the effect of being really high in the preseason poll is kind of like too amplified, because we don't really have any evidence of a team that like isn't UConn in a lot of ways not running the table from then on out and dominating through the tournament too. So you run the risk of kind of making inferences from too little data. And then the other thing is, you know, it doesn't take into account coaching. It doesn't take into account all of the things that I think have to go into UConn beyond just, you know, preseason rankings and power ratings that explain this astronomical winning streak there.
Right. Does it take into account history, as in ELO or some other metric that shows you that UConn this year is not just, let's say, South Carolina having a year 20% better than we've seen from them and being undefeated and playing as well as we've seen UConn play? I would say if you told me that South Carolina team had a 52% chance to win the tournament, I'd be like, that makes sense. With UConn having the same metrics and variables this year, but also being UConn and knowing what kind of run they're on and knowing the factors that you can't bake into it, that's why it seems low.
Yeah, it's like super difficult to disentangle this kind of generic model and the weights that you would put on a generic situation that matches most of the characteristics that we're looking at with the specifics of knowing that this is, after all, UConn, and we haven't seen them lose in XYZ number of years.
So before we move on to the men's tournament, we should note that if there is going to be a year to sort of invest in the other team, the other team's possibility of winning, this is that year. Baylor is second in our model with a 23% chance to win the tournament, and then the two other number one seeds are tops as well. with Notre Dame and South Carolina.
But I'll also note that some of the seeding decisions by the committee were weird. Like Washington, for instance, was a 3 seed, and they ranked number 5 in the whole country, according to Sagarin. And that's kind of a case where by putting Washington kind of like boxed off in a situation where they, you know, will have to travel more, and they also will have to go through a tougher road, that they've sort of kind of taken away chances from one of the teams that might conceivably have a shot.
And same with Maryland as well.
And we've talked about Washington with Kelsey Plum. I think we talked about her on a sig dig, I want to say.
Yeah, she broke Jackie Stiles' all-time scoring record.
And so there seems to be a lot of good narratives to
I mean, I've done the selection committee mock thing, so I understand how challenging it is. But when you see like a team like Washington, where if they could get advanced far in this tournament, there's a great storyline. Same with Maryland getting to the Final Four. Like, that's a Final Four game where even if they were playing on UConn's side of the bracket in the Final Four, you're like, oh, wow, Maryland played them within 6. Like, there's certain things where you're like, your number one goal in the selection committee, of course, is to make it as fair as possible. The second one should be, like, setting up any sort of opportunity where there's the most competitive games possible when it comes to UConn. Right. And that should be, like, number 2. And
so do you think then that you should front load, you should load the UConn side of the bracket, or you want to?
No, I mean, like, in the Final Four being quality games, they haven't been.
Oh, I see your point.
And it's like, why get rid of a Maryland in the Elite Eight when you have fewer eyes on you?
And theoretically, those two things kind of dovetail, because if you're doing the bracket right, you sort of put the weaker teams earlier in UConn's region, and then you kind of make it so that as they progress deeper in, they face these other teams that are more likely to progress through. So it kind of, you know, no matter how you look at it, it makes less than complete sense.
All I can tell you is, having sat through selection Sundays, I would rather have been a 9 seed in a region without UConn than a 2 seed in a region with UConn. Mm-hmm. Because I would in that other region, there's like this fighting chance that you can make the Final Four. So in some ways, the selection committee, I'm like, think about it that way. Like, if you're Maryland, you're like, I'll take a 5 seed over here. Yeah, not a 2 or a 3
you
in UConn.
You want to be the chum in the water for the Sharks or something like that. Okay, now let's talk about the men's tournament. No one is going for perfection. Unfortunately, those damn Gonzaga Bulldogs had to ruin our fun. But instead, we have a very interesting, very weird bracket from what I look. Not quite as strange as last year's, which had all sorts of weird seedings and unexpected slots. But this one, the best team, according to our 538 model, is the Villanova Wildcats, the defending champion Villanova Wildcats. Neil, you've done a little work to show just how good they are. And yet they only have a 15% chance of winning the tournament, which is tied for the lowest in 7 years that we've been doing this this projection.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird dichotomy between a team that, if you throw out that Kentucky team that was going into the tournament undefeated and was just ridiculously dominant, this Villanova team in 2017 has the best power rating, according to the 538 model, of any team since we, you know, started doing this in the ESPN incarnation of 538 4 tournaments ago. So if you look at that alone, you would think, oh, you know, this should be an unusually strong favorite. This should be a good year for them to clean up, especially since the rest of the field doesn't have, like, notably, you know, strong second-place finishers or anything. But then when you crunch the numbers, you find that Villanova only has that 15% chance of winning, which is tied with what Louisville had as a 4 seed in 2014. And you realize that Villanova basically got thrown into sort of the bracket of death. They're in this group where they might have to face Wisconsin, who is no slouch in the second round. Then they have to face probably either Virginia or Florida in the Sweet 16. Then they get, you know, some collection of either SMU or Baylor or even Duke, who a lot of people thought could be a 1 seed after winning the ACC tournament. So there are, like, a lot of teams that could make deep tournament runs just in the East alone. And when you're Villanova, you have to be thinking, if you're Jay Wright, we were considered by the committee to be the number one overall seed in the entire tournament. Why did we get stuck with the most difficult region in the tournament as the 1 seed, kind of as our reward?
And I know 538's model has Villanova as the most likely eventual national champion. But it seems like a lot of the lines coming out of Vegas, there's a couple that actually have Duke as the most likely to win the national championship. Like, and some of that, I'm wondering if it's coming from, like, heat, right? Hot streak. Like, here's this team that just plowed through the ACC tournament. Like, so what's the discrepancy between those two and stat lines.
Yeah, before we keep going and answer that question, let's hear from Stephen A. Smith about why he thinks Duke is going to be the winner.
First of all, let me say, I'm it's just an opinion. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, I watch some college basketball this year, but let me just throw out my little,
Okay, I'm ready for it.
Expertise.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Stir the pot expertise.
Let's go with the East. You see, you got the Villanova Wildcats as the number one seed with Duke at number two. I can't see how Duke is not going to come out of the East. This boy Tatum is on another level. He's special, okay? And I just think with the adversity that they had to deal with throughout this year, they've shown me a lot. I'm going to give them their props where it's due. They're the number two seed in the East. I'm going to pick Duke to come out of that region.
So
I love, by the way, prefacing the I basically know nothing about what I'm about to say, but here is a super strong
take. I cannot see Duke losing.
So, but let's answer Kate's question, Neil, about whether hot teams matter in the tournament. Yeah, Duke ran the table in the ACC tournament, a very tough
Sorry, conference. I'm so excited. We talk about this sometimes, but it's also relevant in the NBA right now with Kerr and the Warriors being like, you know what? It's all right that we're not hot right now in the regular season. It's all right that we're losing. We're getting to see what we need to work on. And like, there are these fighting storylines of whether you're hot and you go into the playoffs or the tourney, you won your conference tournament, or it's like, no. What's really good is if you lose in the conference tournament and then you get to go back and work on the things that you're struggling. I know we
you
can't probably
use
answer
that loss, right?
Yeah.
And then you've gotten it out of your system for the tournament.
I'm assuming that there's just like no, that would be very noisy, is trying to figure out which one of those storylines is actually more true in like in the history of sports. That seems like an impossible thing. But anyway, that's a roundabout way of saying part of the love for Duke is like, no, they're on a hot streak. They just won the NCAA. They finally found their groove.
Yeah, I think that part is probably BS, or at least more so than not, because when I looked at this a couple of years ago, whether, you know, if you perform better than you had during the regular season in your conference tournament and kind of be this hot team that kind of storms through the conference and wins, there's really no relationship between your performance in that particular category and whether you outperform your seed in the NCAA tournament or if you, you know, kind of play better than you would expect based on your regular season resume in the NCAA tournament. So by both of those, there's just really it's you are basically what the regular season numbers said you were, you know, even if you go on this crazy run during
the conference.
But in
Duke's case, they were number one in the preseason.
That's the interesting thing.
Which is Kate's favorite thing to talk about.
Right. Yes. That is
there's a lot of value in that ranking, Chad. That's what I've learned.
That's the thing that cuts against what I just said, is that, you know, Duke is a team that finished 12th in the country in Ken Pomeroy's ratings, and teams that finish that low really don't tend to have, like, a very good chance or don't often, you know, win the NCAA tournament. But the one thing on their resume, when you kind of line up where they rank in all of these different predictive indicators, the fact that they were number one in the preseason AP poll carries a lot of weight. That kind of bolsters your resume. And so if we believe that the play in the conference tournament is fundamentally connected to that preseason ranking and that their true talent is kind of finally coming to the fore over the last handful of games, then maybe that is your case for Duke, you know, that hot streak meaning something beyond, you know, just kind of being the noise of just a small sample of games. The problem there is that even when we take into account that in our model at 538, we still think Villanova is favored to come out of that region and that they would be favored in a head-to-head matchup against Duke. But, you know, Duke is probably better than that number 12 KenPom rating would suggest. I mean, our power ranking considers them to be the sixth best team in the country instead of 12th. Maybe that's kind of what you get for your trouble when you are the number one team in the preseason.
Duke might be the outlier in terms of like a conference champion who, you know, that doesn't necessarily over or underperform because of their early ranking. But I did apply your data to my choice of not picking Michigan, because I'm like, okay, Michigan got hot. They you know, they had the almost tragedy. Then they won their conference tournament. But I'm like, that to me means like you're set up for possible disappointment when it comes to the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, especially
they're more, to me, they're more of like indicative of this. Like, if you're a hot team, will you roll into the NCAA tournament, win a couple games?
I think that's totally right, especially when you consider that their kind of, you know, their late performance is such a kind of divergent pattern from the rest of their resume, and that's across the board in all of the metrics. And then they have that 33rd preseason ranking. You know, if you kind of mix together the AP and the coaches polls. Teams that start the season that low almost never win the NCAA tournament.
Okay. There are other teams in the tournament.
We've named three of them. I think we're doing a good job. We named Michigan, Duke, Villanova.
We have to talk about the team that's kind of the inverse of that, which is Gonzaga. Was that your transition,
Chad? Yeah, it's beautiful, Neil. I don't even have to be here.
The inverse of Duke, you mean?
In the sense that, yeah, exactly.
A team nobody was.
Right. Duke was the number one team in the preseason poll and kind of had for most of the year this sort of disappointing regular season. And now we kind of feel like, well, the talent has coalesced and we have a better sense of who they are as a team after the win against North Carolina and the two wins against North Carolina and the various other, you know, wins that they had in the ACC tournament. Gonzaga is the flip side of that, where nobody really thought much of them going into the season, and they ranked 12th in the preseason poll. But they've really swept through all of the predictive power ratings, especially the KenPom ratings, which we're so fond of here on Hot Takedown. And so they're an example of a team where, especially given their really, really bad strength of schedule in the West Coast Conference, maybe we just don't know that much about them, and Gonzaga maybe gets a little bit of the benefit of the doubt because they do have a tendency to go deep into the tournament to, say, the Sweet 16, sometimes the Elite Eight. Then their benefit of the doubt might start running out because they have not yet been able to kind of make that next step to get to the Final Four.
You know, a team that's confusing me is Kansas, because Ken Pom's ratings don't love Kansas. I mean,
they're a top 10 team.
No, yeah, but he has them at 10th.
Barely.
Barely, and this is a team that was number one. And the reason that the 10th confuses me is because they're 5-1 against top 25. I know it's RPI teams, but still, they seem to be doing the things that would lead to any sort of analysis of them being, you know, a top 5 team.
It's mostly their defensive efficiency, it seems, that's dragging them down, especially compared to the teams above them, where Gonzaga is 10th in the country, Villanova is 2nd, North Carolina is 4th. According to KenPom, West Virginia is higher than Kansas, Louisville, Virginia, Wichita State is higher than Kansas. Wichita State is a 10 seed, and Kansas is a 1
seed. And that also
seems
like a terrible seed for Wichita State. Like,
Wichita
they should have
State
been like a
has
four
gotten,
or five.
I want us to write about whether or not Wichita State overall has been jobbed over the years, or that one year where they were one seed when they were undefeated makes up for it.
And Kansas is also a team whose record is probably propped up by performance in close games. They rank 24th in the country by KenPom's luck metrics. So that's another factor where maybe their record is a little bit better than their underlying
stats. And conference
tournaments
are hard to know what's real and what's not, as we were talking about before. But getting beat by TCU in the Big 12 tournament is not what you want to see before a tournament.
Or, Chad, they went home, they licked their wounds, they regrouped, they assessed their flaws, and they're working on them right now in Lawrence, Kansas.
Bill Self is good at going home, licking his wounds, and assessing his flaws.
Usually after the NCAA tournament.
All right, so we have not talked about UNC. I just want to do our due
they're
and talk
playing.
About all the number one seeds, at least. Then I want to talk about Cinderella's or potential upsets for people filling out their brackets, too. UNC beat twice by Duke, though seems to be one of these teams that KenPom, they are a team that KenPom loves, third overall in the country. To me, they're a sleeper, aside from the fact that they're in the bracket with Kentucky.
They're
and
a
Kentucky, of the number one seeds,
number
yeah,
one seeds.
And Kentucky is actually favored, according to 538's model, to make it out of that region. It's basically 50-50, but slightly ahead of UNC. And so the Blue Bloods are going to have a Blue Blood bath.
Oh, hey. Boy.
Hey?
Yeah, I mean, if it comes to that point and they face off against each other, I think one of the ones when I was filling out my bracket that I had the most difficulty choosing between, because I could see situations, especially if you're thinking about what other people are doing in their bracket and maybe, you know, trying to pick up if you have a thing where you want to try to zig where everyone else is zagging. People might take Kentucky. You know, they seem to have the opinion of the nation behind them more so than even a team like North Carolina. The other interesting team in that region, I think, is UCLA.
My eventual champion.
Well, yeah, they're a team that I think the ratings are not really as fond of as perhaps like the eye test. What are we calling
gaze.
The gaze? The gaze. And also, they're a team that plays a style that you could easily see them either getting really hot and knocking off UNC or Kentucky, whoever they end up having to face. And you could also see them getting cold and flaming out completely. Yeah. And so I don't know. I think they're in the same category as like a Gonzaga where it's like, I don't really know what to make of UCLA.
Real quick, Cinderella's, according to the 538.
I got my pick.
Let's do you guys first.
Yeah. So I'm going to take in Rhode Island to beat Creighton.
Oh, look
love
at
it.
Yep.
You know who else loves that?
I'm also taking Princeton to beat Notre Dame. The model doesn't love that.
Doesn't
but
love that.
I'm a 90s fan. You know, every time I picture Princeton, I picture them playing Pete Carroll's Princeton offense, throwing some backdoor passes.
Backdoor cuts, man.
Almost beating the number one seed. I mean, that's what I picture. So even if that's not the team anymore, I'm going to go with it.
We should note that Princeton has a 25% chance of beating Notre Dame in that first round. Not bad.
Cool. And Rhode Island?
Go. Rhode Island is at 44 of beating an injury-depleted Creighton team.
Good.
Yeah, I was a little disappointed to see Princeton be that low because I sort of instantly had the same thought that you did, Kate, when I was filling out without the benefit of poring over our model on Sunday night.
You fill out your bracket immediately?
Yeah. Don't you, Chad?
I don't
no,
until
I
like,
fill it out Thursday at 11 a.m.
Yeah, until someone prods me enough that I'm like, okay, I got to do this.
I fill it out like a bunch of different times to kind of internalize what the matchups that I'm kind of like interested in are, and especially if the same ones keep coming up a bunch of times. And then I'll like fill out the official one like Wednesday or something like that. But going back to your question about Cinderellas, I mean, our model, if you're defining a Cinderella as a double-digit seed, that has the best chance of making a run to at least the second week of the tournament. Wichita State is sort of the slam dunk no-brainer. They are a 10 seed, even though according to KenPom, they were the 8th best team in the whole country. And so that's a case of the
Wichita
seeding.
Wichita State has a 24% chance of making the Sweet 16.
Right. That's a case of the seeding sort of like going against all advanced metrics. And so take advantage of that if no one else in your bracket is aware of KenPom and are not also likely to take that.
So all those, like, that hot takedown bracket.
Yeah, the hot takedown bracket is screwed for you at that point. Also, like, I mean, I don't know if they qualify. They're a 7 seed, but St. Mary's is a team that was also like super underseeded.
35% chance of being Sweet 16.
Right. And they rank 14th in the whole country, according to KenPom. And so they're in a situation where I wouldn't go so far as to say they could beat Gonzaga if they faced Gonzaga because they lost to them 3 times during the season and by an average of 17 points per game. But if you look at the rest of the way that bracket is setting up, even against good teams like, say, Florida State or West Virginia, St. Mary's could make some noise.
I'll just run off a couple more. Xavier, 17% chance of making Sweet 16. Middle Tennessee, 16% chance. Your Rhode Island Rams?
Yes,
I
Rams.
Think right, Rhode Island Rams, 15% chance of the Sweet 16. And then don't sleep on Oklahoma State, 10% chance.
And just to kind of point out one more thing on this, does it seem to you guys like there are less of these kind of immediate, obvious upset picks in the first round than usual? I kind of, according to things like KenPom, I picked out what felt like were a lot fewer sort of like instant, oh my God, the committee made a horrible mistake and we're going to just put that through immediately in the first round. But I don't know. Did you guys notice the same thing?
Well, we haven't filled out a bracket yet, Neil.
Oh, you Thursday punks.
Certainly it is the case, though, that I'm not yet convinced that using KenPom and trying to get the like arbitrage that way and capitalizing on those inefficiencies is the way to do it.
I'm not sure that using any information at all
that's my
is
point.
The way to do
it's
it.
It's so
that's
random
the Stephen A. Smith
that
method.
I would have to play for hundreds of years before I like came out ahead because I started using the metrics over something else.
I had a bracket in like the 98th percentile last year
that's
and
right.
did it in 3 right. and a half minutes and did it and just click things. So
all right. Well, let's leave it there and move on to football. Before we keep going with this week's show, let's get a word from one of our sponsors. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by Casper. Get a Casper mattress and get a great night's sleep. You can try it for 100 nights risk-free. All you have to do is go to Casper.com Patreon.com/takedown and use the code takedown for $50 towards the purchase of your Casper mattress. Terms and conditions do apply. Right now, moving on to football, where NFL free agency has begun. Before we get this segment started, Kate, you and I had a side bet about how long it would take us to get to football. I forget the number of episodes, but
it's
I'm pretty
more.
Sure you won. Oh, really?
Oh, I thought you was three, and
well,
I think
I'm
was
the one
four.
Who thought we were doing this podcast for 3 years. So
yeah,
true. Okay, I shouldn't have spoken so quickly. You're right, I won.
Yeah, I remember, Chad, you said that it would take until like April or May or something like that until we talked again about football.
We forgot.
All right. So here to talk about football is ESPN the Magazine's Mina Kimes. Mina, hello.
Hey, guys. Football never ends. So, FYI.
I know. That's the problem, Mina.
That's what I told him, Mina.
And it's exciting now. Free agency. It's my favorite time of year.
Exactly. So free agency has been happening for half a week to a week now. Lots of stuff has already happened. There was a flurry of activity. Let's start with quarterbacks, where I want to talk about Brock Osweiler, who I feel like is like just mediocre enough to be fascinating. You know what I mean? Like, we on this show keeps coming back to him because he's involved in these interesting situations that someone really good or really bad wouldn't be. And so Osweiler was traded from the Texans to the Browns. Interestingly, the Texans threw in a draft pick so that the Browns would be encouraged to take Osweiler and his giant contract. So, Mina, have we seen this kind of thing before where someone costs so much more than what they're worth that they're sort of like, you need to, instead of a team covering for salary, they get a whole extra draft pick from it?
Not in the NFL. I mean, this is really new territory for football. It's a very NBA-style trade in some ways. And, you know, you mentioned that they threw in the draft pick. I would say they threw in Brock Osweiler. Sashi Brown, the VP of Football Operations for the Browns, who are a very analytically driven organization, you know, they employ Paul DePodesta, was asked about the trade afterwards and then delivered maybe the most savage quote about it, which he said, "We're really excited to acquire a second-round draft choice in this trade." So he did not mention Brock Osweiler, which was incredible. So, yeah, basically they ate his salary for the draft pick, and it was $16 million. And they might potentially move him again and offset that a little bit if they cut him and he gets picked up. But ultimately, they bought a draft pick. This does not happen in the NFL.
So, Mina, you mentioned that this is kind of an NBA-style trade, and I completely agree with you on that. Do you think that this is sort of the product of the Browns, like you mentioned, being an analytic organization and kind of thinking about ways to kind of find market inefficiencies that haven't been tapped yet in the NFL? And if so, do you think this signals sort of like maybe the start of what might be a trend toward these kind of NBA-style, like guys are walking contracts instead of like actual players trades?
I absolutely think it was, you know, a market inefficiency, which in this case was Houston making a terrible decision last year to pay Brock Osweiler and then being so desperate and so convinced of his mediocrity that they were willing to move on him and admit that they made a mistake. I am not sure if it's something that we'll see happen again because it really was a confluence of, I think, two situations that were perfectly suited, which is to say Houston really wanting to get rid of him and an organization in Cleveland that values draft picks so much, that came into this draft this offseason, I believe, with over $100 million in cap space and a desire to continue amassing draft picks.
Right. I mean, it seems like it would be hard to continue to make moves like this going forward just because there aren't a ton of Brock Osweilers, not just him, but guaranteed contracts that you need to get rid of. And most guys who do have guaranteed contracts, you usually want to hold on to them. But I do want to know, because I read Bill, your good friend Bill Barnwell's piece trying to explain what the actual cost was to the Browns for buying the second round pick. Because we don't quite know yet. I mean, they obviously took on Brock Osweiler's $16 million, but now there's value in Brock Osweiler, even if they eat some of his money and then trade him. What do you think, when you look at the numbers, what do you think is a decent amount to pay for a second round draft pick? I think obviously $16 million is ridiculously high, but like what's a decent amount?
Yeah, no, it's a great question because like how much are draft picks actually worth is a moving target depending on, you know, the cap and what the team is. You know, as I mentioned, the Browns have $100 million in room, so their price is different from another team. I agree, $16 million is too high. a backup quarterback like Brock Osweiler could cost about $6 million, $5 million. So if the price goes down to, you know, 10, 11, it suddenly looks a little bit less crazy. But all this is irrelevant unless they use the pick well, which the Browns have struggled with over the last few years. I mean, that's where the Sixers analogy comes in, right? Which is you can amass all the draft picks in the world, but if you don't find the right talent, it's a meaningless strategy. So this draft is going to be so essential for not only the team, but I think how people view, I hate to use this word, but their process.
So let's move on from Osweiler to two quarterbacks who were backups, essentially, and I think some would believe are starters waiting to happen, Tony Romo and Jimmy Garoppolo. Neither of the quarterbacks have moved yet. There's discussion of a trade for Romo, and Garoppolo, I think, Instagrammed or something, saying...
He was hacked, Chad.
Oh, is that what he claimed?
Yes, he was hacked.
Oh, I didn't realize. The Russians have him, too.
Yes.
So, you know, what are we... These are two very different quarterbacks as far as the state of their career that they're in, but it does seem as though there's more fluidity in the quarterback market this season, at least for names, than there has been in the past. Mina, do we have any inkling of what – is this going to be a carousel situation where one quarterback moves one place and then that triggers another quarterback move, or has that carousel already begun?
Romo is kind of the key to everything right now, insofar as, you know, it looks like there's not going to be a trade from him. The two of the teams that seem to be in the running for him are Denver and Houston. If either of those teams make him an offer, that's worth it to him, by the way, because, you know, Tony Romo has been injured a lot. And so for him to continue playing, obviously he's a competitive guy. He knows he's still a top 10 quarterback in talent, but for him to continue playing and risk his health, it has to be at the right price. So if he signs with one of those teams, suddenly everything else comes into place with the remaining quarterbacks. There are still a lot of teams that need quarterbacks. Cleveland, San Francisco, the Jets. All of them have murky situations right now. So I don't think we're going to know what's going to happen with Jimmy either for a while, because nobody knows what the Patriots are willing to take.
And do you think the reason that we haven't seen movement on Romo is because Denver and Houston aren't willing to trade for him, because they know if they're unwilling to trade that then the Cowboys will release Romo and the price will be better? You'll just have to pay Romo's salary rather than give up a draft pick. I mean, because to me it seems like if you really need a quarterback, it's kind of like the buy it now button on eBay. You know you're paying a premium, and you're paying that premium so that something doesn't hit the market. I'm confused, I guess. Maybe you can break down for me. Like, why wouldn't the Broncos or Houston think it's worth it to give up some sort of value to ensure that they get Romo?
Well, so the issue with Romo, right, is that so compared to Jimmy, he's obviously an incredibly proven quarterback, but he also is a massive injury risk. These teams would love to take him on with a contract on their own terms that has some sort of injury aspect baked into it, right, and not just take on his existing contracts. So I think that's a big part of it. Part of it is also seeing what he's willing to take. I don't think anyone really knows that right now. He is the most attractive quarterback available, clearly, but for a lot of teams, even given that, because of his injury risk, they still don't want it.
Now, do you think the Broncos might be in kind of a unique position where they do have this great defense and they really have been, especially this past year, like a quarterback, a functional quarterback away from jumping right back into the middle of the, you know, very top of the Super Bowl contending list, that there might be some extra pressure on them to get something done just, you know, before the window with that defense closes?
Everybody thought that going into this last season. Okay, the Broncos have the defense. They have everything. They just need a quarterback who plays competently. And the crazy thing was Trevor Siemian was better than Peyton Manning was in his final season, but they had other weaknesses they didn't anticipate, which is to say their offensive line really, really stunk last year. And the defense had some new weaknesses as well in stopping the run, so they needed to address those situations, which they did. I would actually argue that Houston is more one piece away at this point. They played the Patriots really tough in the playoffs. And when you saw how Brock Osweiler basically crippled their chances, you couldn't help but watch the game and think, man, if they just had a competent quarterback, this team suddenly can make the entire conference look interesting.
Yeah, and Houston has had this, like, crazy kind of revolving door of quarterbacks over the past 4 years to, like, the last year of Matt Schaub, then it was, like, Ryan Fitzpatrick, Brian Hoyer, and then Brock Osweiler. So maybe for them, like, just any kind of stability there, even if it's, like, 1 or 2 years of Romo, but, like, playing like the Romo of old would be amazing compared to what they've been getting.
It's just so true of every team right now, right? Like, when you see a player like Mike Glennon get nearly $19 million guaranteed from Chicago.
Oh, man, yeah.
You realize, just, man, all these Chicago and other franchises actually cycled through quarterbacks until Jay Cutler regime, which, you know, finally ended. But you realize just how so many of these teams, just, you don't even need a great quarterback. All they need is a pretty good quarterback to be in the mix, and you realize how few quarterbacks are even at that level.
Mina, the big news in the NFL today is Eddie Lacy moving from the Packers to the Seahawks, signing 1 year, $3 million of it guaranteed, around $5 million if he earns all of it. It's tough to know coming off of Ezekiel Elliott being drafted so high, and proving his value, but then you've got Adrian Peterson with like a huge contract. I feel like we're in an odd state of knowing just by looking at a contract number whether there was value in it or not when it comes to the running back position. When you saw the number for Eddie Lacy, who has had so many ups and downs, did you think, oh, that's a value contract?
Yeah, and I'm a crazy Seahawks fan. You guys know that. So I was
waiting. There's some bias here is what you're telling me.
A lot of bias and a lot of nerves, because I actually didn't. So there's a lot of running backs still out there right now. Adrian Peterson, Jamal Charles, Latavius Murray, were all rumored to be visiting Seattle. Those, by the way, Adrian Peterson and Jamal Charles, two of the greatest running backs of their generation, and it's not clear that teams want them. That's kind of where we are right now with old running backs. The issue with Adrian Peterson, I think this will continue to be the issue with him as the market develops, is that he has almost never run out of shotgun, and more teams, including the Seahawks, are running that way. So he is a bad scheme fit for a lot of teams. Eddie Lacy still has a lot of upside. He's a lot younger. With him, obviously, there's the weight issue, which has impacted his performance in the past. That's a $5.5 million with $3 million guaranteed. So you do have to wait to see how these deals shake out in terms of what the non-guaranteed money is. Is it incentives, et cetera? But, yeah, I mean, it's crazy to see a fullback like Kyle Juszczyk get paid almost as much as that, actually more than that, by San Francisco, and to say, wow, like, running backs really are not getting paid anymore in today's NFL.
And from Seattle's perspective, do you think any of this is sort of like a big reaction to the fact that they had built their little kind of dynasty run on being able to pound the ball and run the ball? And last year that pretty much kind of evaporated. They were 23rd in DVOA running the ball. Do you think that maybe, you know, this is part of their plan to get back to what kind of made Seahawks football the way it was on offense, at least?
Absolutely. And it also reflects the fact that they did not land a top offensive lineman. You know, I was just saying the running back market was really weak. The offensive line market was insane this offseason. I mean, guys who were very mediocre, you know, like Matt Khalil, Mike Remmers, Riley Reiff, were getting paid. So Seattle was not able to sign TJ Lang, who was a very top guard who went to Detroit. So what they, I believe, felt was that, okay, if we can't bolster the offensive line, we need a running back like Eddie Lacy who can break tackles so that we can continue running the same zone blocking scheme that we've run in the past.
So, I mean, I have one last question for you, and it's about the offensive line salaries that you mentioned. One of the tricks is that, you know, it seems like there aren't a lot of offensive linemen in the draft who teams want to take, and so that inflated partly the market for who was going to be signed in the offseason of people who are already in the NFL. And I'm wondering, you've reported on contracts in the NFL quite a bit, and I'm wondering if do agents try and stagger that kind of thing where they look at recruiting rankings and who's and sort of whether certain positions are stronger and so when certain positions will be lighter or stronger in the draft, or is that too much of a crapshoot so you can't quite time it out?
I think they want to, but it is pretty hard to predict. But I mean, it's a great point, which is that part of the reason the offensive line market is so rich and inflated right now is because it's a weak offensive line draft. Compare that to, say, wide receivers and the pass rush, you know, where I think the draft is looking really good at those positions. So you see fewer giant contracts being thrown around because teams know, or tight ends is another position that I think is going to be really good. So teams know that they can get a tight end.
That'd be an interesting study for us to do, Neil, at 538, is see whether or not the free agency dollars are commensurate with the order of picks, you know, for each position or something like that in the draft.
Yeah, I think, you know, there might be like a lot of noise in there, but it is kind of an interesting thought of just kind of the limits to how much you can predict what will be available on the market, including the free agency and the draft.
Cool. Mina, thanks for coming by and talking about football as ever. Best of luck getting home from Bristol.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
All right, take care. Before we keep going with this week's show, let's get a word not from one of our sponsors, but from something that Hot Takedown and all of 538's podcast is involved in this month. It's Tripod. It's a little initiative to try and get more people to try podcasts. If you have someone in your life who has not tried to listen to a podcast, or if you have a favorite podcast that you want to recommend to listeners, go ahead and tell them about it this month. Lots of shows are asking their listeners to do this, and so we'd love if you did the same, and you can tweet at us with hashtag Tripod. Thanks very much, and look forward to hearing your recommendations. All right, now it's that time of our show when a telling number from the world of sports is brought to us. We call it the significant digit. This week, we're very sad about who's bringing us our significant digit because it's the last time that she'll be with us for Hot Takedown. It's our departing intern, Kara Chin. Kara!
Hi.
Hi. I can't be too excited when I say your name because it's just sadness. Kara, what do you have for us this week?
So 217 minutes and 14 seconds. So that was the playtime for a hockey game in Norway. And people were wondering where their family was because I guess phones died. And
so how many periods is that? Or how many overtimes, I guess?
There were eight overtimes.
Eight overtimes. Wow. So a traditional hockey game is 60 minutes, stack eight overtimes on top of that. Kate, what's the longest basketball game you played? How many overtimes?
Two overtimes.
That's it?
That's it? That's weak.
Come on.
There was once in the women's tourney a four overtime game between Duke and someone. Famous, famous game. And exciting game. I don't know if – I'm assuming this was exciting and had stakes involved as well.
Well, but hockey's sudden death. I assume that Norwegian hockey is like that too. Who knows? But so there it's sort of drab, right? Like nothing –
It seems like it would be more likely that a hockey would go so many overtimes because you don't have to have the exact same score at the end. I mean, you do, but it's not so many scores. You know what I'm saying? Like, if it's like 2-2, cool, as opposed to landing on 106, right. 106. Right. Wow. I almost became part of our hot takedown montage by saying you have to end with the same score. But I'm attempting to clarify that it seems harder to have more overtimes in a basketball game.
Yeah, I think that's true.
I agree with that statement.
Okay, thanks.
The winning score was 2-1, by the way.
God, that's a lot of hockey to get to 2-1.
I'd have been out after the second period. That's my game plan anyway.
Yeah.
The traffic.
We should point out that the NHL record is only 116 minutes of overtime. How weak is that?
Of overtime. So total,
overtime.
Add 60 minutes to that,
yeah.
Neil.
It's not close, I guess.
Seven. We're getting there.
On March 24th, 1936, the Montreal Maroons and the Detroit Red Wings played six overtimes before Mud Brunetteau scored.
And they weren't even wearing helmets then. Think of all
Neil knew that off the top of his head.
Yeah, per usual. Kara, it's been such a pleasure having you. Thanks for coming on.
It's great to be here.
I meant for the whole internship, not just for the significant digit segment.
Thanks, Kara.
I meant the same.
All right. Thanks, Kara.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
That will do it for this week's show, folks. Thanks for talking about sports. Kate Fagan.
Thanks, Chad.
Neil Payne.
Thanks, Chad.
I hope we brightened your day, Neil,
doing
this show.
I feel better.
You were struggling before you got into the studio, but
was
now.
Was he all grumpy?
He was a grumpy Neil. He admitted as much, which I appreciate. I always like
up front
when people declare their emotional states because I think makes life a lot easier to live if you know where everyone's at.
Should we start doing that at the top of the show?
Do a little check-in.
For our listeners or
Hi,
for
Kate.
Each other?
Yeah, no, I'll be like, and I'm in an excited mood today.
Yeah, that's good. It's like a live journal with the little emojis at the end that tell me how you're
live
feeling.
Journal, Chad.
All right. Our podcast producer is Katie Ferguson. Our podcast.
Mud Brunetteau.
Snow Shoveler.
Mud what?
Mud Brunetteau.
He's
Mud
the guy who Brunetteau broke the score in the hockey.
Is Jody Avergan. Our intern for the last time is Kara Chin. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Jorge Estrada. Tony made it in. I think Jorge's in the booth, but Tony made it in despite the snow. Katie made it in despite the snow. Kara made it in despite the snow. That's dedication. I appreciate all of their efforts to sludge through. You can find us on your favorite podcasting app. We'd love to hear what you think at podcast@538.com or on iTunes. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Listeners, thanks for listening for the last half century.